This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. It's the season of giving. On today's show, we celebrate people who help others, no matter what the time of year and no matter what the obstacles. We meet Israeli volunteers who go to the West Bank to help Palestinians with their olive harvests. They also protect them from attacks by Jewish settlers.
It seems to work as a deterrent. If we have a busload of Israelis, there's less violence.
Plus, in Florida, seniors stitch dolls for kids in Darfur. And Ugandan folk artist Samite ministers with music to children scarred by war.
Usually music is the first thing that disappears when there's a war. Even the birds that sing in the morning stop singing. So I know from my past experience being in a refugee camp, when you hear music, it really uplifts your soul.
First, this hour's news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. For many Americans and people all across the globe, this holiday season will be a little different. The economic meltdown means many Christmas lists will be shorter and pocketbooks a little tighter. But that hasn't stopped the spirit of giving. This week, we want to focus on the inspiring ways people are giving of their time and resources. Take our first story out of the Middle East. You might remember last week, the Israeli government clashed with Jewish settlers illegally living in the West Bank. In retaliation, the settlers went on a rampage, slashing tires, smashing windows, and setting fire to Palestinian olive groves. Many Palestinians depend on their olive groves for their livelihoods. So who's come to their aid? A group of Israeli volunteers. Daniel Estrin brings us this story from the West Bank.
It's raining olives, dozens of hard, shiny olives. They're falling from the tree onto a tarp below. The drizzle of olives is soothing in a land drenched by harsh sounds. This small olive tree grove is right across the street from a major Israeli army checkpoint. Armored military vehicles pass by every few minutes.
This was a plane passing the sound barrier.
Hillela is an Israeli volunteer with the organization Rabbis for Human Rights. She and three other Israelis woke up at dawn to get to this modest olive grove of 125 trees. The grove is owned by a retired Palestinian couple who greeted the Israelis with hugs. Why are Israeli volunteers helping an Arab family pick their olives? It's because of the neighbors. On a nearby hill sits a small Israeli settlement. Many of the Jews who live there believe the whole of the West Bank is Jewish land. Recently, Israeli settlers have destroyed olive trees, pelted stones at farmers, and taunted olive pickers. Sometimes it's in revenge for settlers killed by Palestinian gunfire. But lately, violence has increased in retaliation for Israel's efforts to evict Jewish settlers from areas they illegally occupy. One man from the neighboring settlement stopped his car in front of the olive trees and honked his horn for a few minutes straight. But that doesn't wipe the grin off of Abdul Halim Udi's face. He's a retired school principal. This is the first time in 7 years he's come to harvest his trees. Because his land is so close to the settlement, the army prevented him from harvesting and plowing there to minimize clashes. Now Abdul Hadi's where he loves to be, up on a ladder, raking off dark olives from the branches of his trees.
Here, much quantity. It's good, very good.
The Israeli volunteers here today include Yona Ben Tal and Yoel Mintner, who are in their 70s. They're picking olives by hand and dropping them onto the tarp below.
Olive symphony in B flat major.
When you take off the olives, it's so good for the tree.
Yoel knows. He's a retired farmer himself. Now, once a week, he's in the West Bank, helping Palestinian landowners with the harvest.
When my grandchildren will ask me about these horrible times of Israel as an occupier of the Western Bank, I could tell them, listen, I have tried to help, and I did some good things.
When the tree has been stripped bare, Abdul Halim's wife, Nihad, sits on a black tarp and separates the olives into two piles. Nihad is a retired English teacher. Her bright red hair, dyed with henna, peeks out from under her veil.
I am collecting the olives. some of them I will make olives to eat, and the other we will make it oil.
Many Palestinians sell olive oil, pickled olives, and even olive-based soaps. But olives mean much more than just a livelihood. In fact, olives are an all-important symbol for both Palestinians and Israelis. In Judaism, the olive branch is a symbol of peace, mentioned in the Jewish Bible. And in Palestinian culture, olive trees are noted for being strong and deep-rooted, the way Palestinians like to view themselves and their connection to this land. And the olive is mentioned a number of times in the Quran. Sitting on the ground, surrounded by olives, Nihad recites a passage in which God invokes an olive when extolling the creation of man.
I've seen farmers cry when they've come out to the field and found a tree damaged or cut down.
Rabbi Yechiel Greneman is a founding member of Rabbis for Human Rights. Rabbi Greneman says the Israeli army made additional efforts this year to allow for a peaceful harvest. Still, attacks on harvesters actually increased, so the rabbis have been sending volunteers out to the fields.
It seems to work as a deterrent. If we have a busload of Israelis, there's less violence.
Jewish settler violence against Palestinians and their olive trees both enrages and shames him.
And people tell us that the idea that we're acting out of the religious tradition for them saves Judaism or saves the name of Judaism, and that's one of our main motivations.
Back in the olive grove, the group is back on their feet after breaking for hummus and fava beans. Then, a settler drives by, stops his car, and makes a cell phone call. Minutes later, a convoy of soldiers arrives, followed by two cars full of young residents of the nearby settlement. What kind of permission do they have to work here? A soldier asks one of the Israeli volunteers. Rabbis for Human Rights must coordinate with the Israeli army before they can pick olives with Palestinian landowners. What followed was a half-hour game of phone tag to try to get a hold of the higher-up whom they notified. All the while, Nihad and Abdul Halim picked olives at a frantic pace. Then the soldiers in charge declared there was no record of permission. Both Israelis and Palestinians had to leave the land. The olive pickers picked up their belongings and left the grove. The soldiers got back in their armored vehicles and drove away. The settlers hopped back in their cars and sped up the hill. Abdul Halim and Nihad each hugged a bucket of freshly picked olives. Determined, like deeply rooted olive trees, they said they'd be back to pick the next day. For the World Vision Report, I'm Daniel Estrin in the West Bank.
You've heard the saying, it's better to give than receive. But did you know it was backed by scientific research? A study published in the journal Science earlier this year found that people who give money to those in need are happier than they would have been if they had kept the money for themselves. Giving, the Harvard University study concludes, makes you feel good. We hear that from a woman in Sichuan, China, the site of a major earthquake earlier this year.
I am Fu Mingbi. I am 50 years old. On the day of the earthquake, I gave lots of things to the children from the high school. We gave our curtains for those who were injured, and we gave them fruit to eat. We also took all of our clothes from the closets and gave them to the people that were injured. After the earthquake, people from Hong Kong came to visit us, and they brought money. They gave each of our family members 100 yuan. That was the best gift I have ever received. Maybe in the city, for people that are not farmers, they might find 100 yuan is not much. But in our rural area, 100 means a lot. We say, 李小情义大. The gift may be small, but the feeling behind it is big.
Giving money to someone can be complicated. Kelsey Timmerman discovered that when he was in Bangladesh. He was spending the day with a garment worker, doing research for a book he was writing. Kelsey sent us this commentary.
I've got $20 in my pocket, and Arifa could use it more than me. Arifa is a garment worker and a single mother. She lives with her 4-year-old daughter and 11-year-old son. She's taken me to her factory to meet some of the workers. The sun is low in the sky and turns the dust from the rush hour hustle and bustle pink. The garment industry accounts for about 3/4 of Bangladesh's exports. Many economists believe it offers people here a way out of extreme poverty. They might be right, but after spending the day with Arifa, it's hard to imagine that her job offers much hope for a brighter future. Her one-room apartment is constructed out of anything and everything. Cardboard insulates the roof and the walls, the studs are bamboo, the floor concrete. The room's single window is nothing more than an asymmetrical hole cut in the sheet metal wall. It's covered by a shredded curtain, a heartbreaking attempt to spruce up the place. This morning I watched her chop vegetables on the floor with a rusty blade. After breakfast, she helped her son with his homework using her mobile phone's calculator function. While she prepared lunch over a gas stove, I gave in to the heat of the day and fell asleep on one of the room's bamboo beds. When I awoke, I had a pillow under my head and a fan directed on me. For lunch, I was served rice. Not just any kind of rice, but some kind of smaller-grained, imported rice, reserved for guests of honor. All day, I've been looking for a good opportunity to give her that $20 bill that's tucked in my pocket. But so far, it hasn't felt right. I'm a guest in her house, and I don't want to insult her. Still, she could use the money more than me, but my opportunities are growing fewer. Some guy, maybe her boyfriend, met us at her apartment and is walking with us to the factory. He's creepy in a lurch sort of way. Out on the street, Arifa stops 300 feet short of the factory gate. Any further, and my presence might cause a problem. The factory owners would not welcome a consumer concerned about their workers. As the workers walk through the factory gate at the end of their day, people, cars, and trucks filled with fabric jockey for position. To me, it's chaos. To them, it's 6 o'clock. The sun sets on my day with Arifa. She flags me a taxi. The first is too expensive, and she sends it packing. The next, she bargains down. Whether a pillow under the head, a fan directed on me, the honor of short-grained rice, or saving me a few cents to get back to my hotel, Arifa looked after me the entire day while giving me a glimpse of her daily life. This is my last chance. I fingered the $20 in my pocket. It's nearly an entire month's worth of Arifa's wages. I look at Lurch, standing beside her. I would just hand her the money if it weren't for him. He might question what she's done to earn it. I pull my hand out empty and wave goodbye.
That was writer Kelsey Timmerman. Kelsey tells us that a few days later, just before he left Bangladesh, he took a taxi to Arifa's apartment, ran up the 6 flights of stairs, and gave Arifa his remaining local currency and one $20 bill. Kelsey Timmerman is the author of Where Am I Wearing? A global tour to the countries, factories, and people that make our clothes. Just ahead on the World Vision Report, the gift of music. We talk with Ugandan musician Samite. Stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. This week, we're talking about giving.
Hi, my name is Tseho, and I live out in Johannesburg in South Africa. The greatest gift I've ever received was family and friends and their time and their prayers. And the greatest gift I've ever given was to be for my son. Spending time with him as well, telling him how much I love him, and reading a story to him at night.
Hi, my name is Kate. I'm from Johannesburg, South Africa. The best Christmas gift that I've ever given someone was when I was really little and I made a picture for my mother when I was in primary school. The best gift I've ever received was a Justin Timberlake concert ticket.
My name is Ntanta from Johannesburg, South Africa. The best gift I was ever given was car sound for my 21st birthday from my mother. And the best gift I've ever given was opening up my home to a friend after a parent of hers died and she needed a place to go. So I opened our doors and that's it.
In the 1980s, Samite Mulondo was one of East Africa's most celebrated musicians. He was also a refugee. Samite had been forced to flee his home in Uganda after his brother was killed in political violence. Samite now lives in the U.S., but he's never forgotten Africa or his time in a refugee camp. It's what drives him to go back, to visit troubled regions that have been devastated by conflict and war. Samite says his goal is to bring victims of violence the greatest gift he has, music.
Usually music is the first thing that disappears when there's a war, when people start hearing gunshots. Even the birds that sing in the morning stop singing. So I know from my past experience being in a refugee camp, when you hear music, it really uplifts your soul. And it helps you to even think, okay, this is not the end.
6 years ago, you started an organization called Musicians for World Harmony, and this is the group that sends musicians and their music into the refugee camps. How does it work?
In the past few years, it's expanded now. We don't only go to refugee camps. We also go to AIDS orphanages in Kenya. And these are musicians from the U.S., musicians from other countries, but we also encourage musicians in the countries that we visit because we don't want it to be a one-time experience. So we encourage and we sponsor local musicians in the areas to go and visit in these refugee camps and play music to people who need the healing power of music.
Well, I'd like to hear what it's like when you go in with musicians into these places. You say that the music is gone, so you're bringing it back. And what's that like? What are the faces of the children like when you start singing and playing your instruments?
The kids, it's like somebody's bringing them food. They get very excited. And what happens is the kids allow you to sing or three or four songs, and then they can we also sing? So it's not like you would be on a stage in America. You just bring back the music. You make it possible for them to feel okay to sing themselves.
So the children sing with you?
The children sing with me and in the orphanages. The children, actually, after singing, then they feel okay to talk. You don't force them to talk. But if they want to talk about something, then you have to be prepared because they will totally open up and say whatever they're feeling on their heart.
Samite, you've just returned from visiting with former child soldiers in the Democratic Republic of Congo, mm-hmm. where there's been so much conflict and recently an increase in violence in some parts. Tell us a little bit about that trip and the children that you saw there.
Wow, that trip was just really amazing because it's the first time that I actually was with so many of them. In the past, when I've worked with former child soldiers, it's been like one-on-one, maybe two at a time. But this time I was working with big groups. And they were from the ages of about, say, 14 to 17. And these kids, what they've seen in their lifetime is totally unbelievable. You know, you can't imagine anybody would go through this and still have a smile on their faces. But the program I designed this time was to show them what you can do with music. Music can make you happy. Music can make you sad. Music can help you bring back beautiful memories or whatever you want the world to hear also because people listen to music. So I told them, okay, if you're given a chance to record, what would you want the world to hear? And it just was beautiful to hear what these kids came up with.
We have some of that music. Let's play one of the songs. I think it's called Jeshi Si Kazi Ya Watoto. I've probably really messed up that name.
No, you actually did an amazing job with it.
I did. Oh, good.
Yes.
Well, can we play a little bit about that and then talk about it?
Sure.
Wanasiasa mwena zamili Jeshi si yo kazi ya watoto Wanasiasa mwena zamili Jeshi siyo kazi ya watoto Wanasiasa mwena zamini Jeshi siyo kazi ya watoto Wanasiasa mwena zamini Jeshi siyo kazi ya watoto
Now, these are all former child soldiers with incredible
yes.
stories, you say. What are they singing about there?
That one is really beautiful. That the one who led the song, you know, what the way we did it was like, okay, you come up with a song and then you teach all of us and then we'll back you up as background vocals. So what he's saying that the military is not a job for for children. And he wanted the world to hear that. And this young man had actually killed over 26 people. He counted, and he was forced to kill.
You know, after the kinds of trauma these children have been through, it's amazing to hear them singing with such energy and maybe even resilience. How do they do that? You'd almost think they'd be curled up in fetal position in a corner somewhere.
Exactly. I believe they've gone through that stage also in their lives. But, for example, these kids were at a UNICEF shelter, so they can see there's a future. And actually, this came out also, you know, very much also in the artwork that they drew for this organization. They would draw their life before, and they would draw their life during child soldiers, and they would draw life now, and they would draw what they think the future is like. So these kids haven't lost it. They really believe there's a future for them. You know, I think when you reach all the way to the bottom, then there's only one way to go, is to the top, you know, have hope. And when they sing, you feel it. You actually feel it like, wow, these kids, you know, haven't given up.
And you've been inspired by the child soldiers, Samita. In fact, I understand a few years ago, you heard a particular story about a young boy who had been a soldier, and you wrote a song called The Last Time My Father Carried Me.
Yes.
Tell me about that song.
Somebody wanted me to write music for a film they were working on. They met this young man who, his village was raided by these rebels in northern part of Uganda, and they kidnapped everybody, especially the young men, and he was so young that the rebels made his father carry him. Eventually, his father got tired, and he tried to put him down, and the rebels said, keep carrying him. And, of course, the old man couldn't continue carrying him. He eventually had to put him down, and the rebels asked the young man, kill your father because he's useless. And the father knew that if the young man didn't kill him, the young man would be killed instead. So he told the young man, go ahead and kill me. You won't be cursed. You'll be blessed and you'll be very successful in life. So the young boy killed his father and ended up joining the rebels and fighting for the rebels, you know, with the rebels. And one day he escaped. And now he's really doing well in school and he's moved on with his life. He's actually going with his father's blessings. He's really going to be successful.
Let's play a little bit of the song that you wrote about that boy.
Okay.
Teddy Chama, 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 Teddy Chama.
What are you saying? What are the lyrics?
The message is like, you're not holding me down. That whatever they are doing to him, it's not going to hold him back. He's going to move forward.
Mm-hmm. Now, Samita, you yourself grew up in Uganda, and at one point you became a refugee and were in a camp. Is it fair to assume that this is part of what's driven you to go back to refugee camps, or at least part of the reason?
Definitely, that's part of the reason. Being in a refugee camp, for me, I think was just preparing me for what I'm doing right now. You know, as musicians, we are always wondering, why am I here? Not only musicians, I guess everybody does. What is my purpose? So I think my purpose is to do what I'm doing. And being in a refugee camp was just a preparation for, you know, for what I'm going through right now.
You could fill up your weeks and months with sold out shows in the U.S. and Canada. Why have you chosen this?
Once you see this child soldier, you see the eyes focusing again and you see a little, you know, like star, you see the tears of joy in the eyes. It's way more satisfying than being on stage and making hundreds of people dancing. And also you get this other feeling which you have sometimes, like, if I don't do it, who's going to do it? If I go back and just think about myself, who else is going to remember these kids, especially when you meet these young kids like I just met in Congo, whose music is so amazing and who said, when you go back, make sure people hear our music, make sure people hear our message. Then you feel like you are actually, you know, their only voice. Can you imagine taking guns away from these kids' hands and putting a guitar in their hands? It's the most satisfying experience.
I bet. We're going to listen to another song, and this one isn't from child soldiers, but from a young woman that you met in one of the refugee workshops. And I believe this song is called Hakuna Amani?
Mm-hmm.
watu wa Afrika wasema kwamba Afrika imejakilio, si Afrika peke. Wa Arabu wengi walia kwa vitambavyo iliyo ingizwa.
Who is this young woman and what is her story?
When I finished visiting former child soldiers, I spent time with victims. As you've heard, there are a lot of cases going on in the Congo where women are subjected to rape. So there are a lot of victims there of sexual abuse. And some of these women that I spent time singing with had gone through, you know, sexual abuse. And what I did with them also was what I did with a former child soldier. I said, what if, you know, you're given a chance to hear yourself in a recording? And this is what this young girl came up with, which made everybody quiet. You have to realize there were some boys there who were showing off, singing hip-hop and rap music. And when they had this song, it completely changed the whole mood. And then from there on, it was just messages of peace. And she's singing that we need peace. Hakuna amani, there's no peace. And she's talking about what the war does. When you realize that they'd gone through so much suffering, especially being on the other end where they're the ones who are being totally sexually abused and beaten and, you know, completely mistreated by these soldiers, it's amazing that these girls came up with these amazing songs.
And it's interesting how the music carries the stories. You mentioned earlier that you play for a while and the musicians that you bring in through your organizations play, but the kids want to start singing. Is there something about the music, do you find, that allows them to tell their stories in ways that they might not be able to do without music?
I think music kind of helps you to, you know, center you, bring you to a peaceful place. An example I can give you, I didn't record this, but I was visited this hospital called Panzi. In this hospital, there are like a lot of victims in Congo of sexual abuse. And these were about 150 women that I was put in front and say, okay, they are all yours, Samite. I only sang like 3 songs to these women. And one of them took off and said, okay, now you sit down. And they started singing and they made me sing with them. And soon we were jumping up and down. And these were women who were actually waiting to see a doctor. You know, so definitely music is powerful.
So you're in the hospital surrounded by 150 women who have been raped and wounded.
Yes,
and
exactly.
They start singing with you. Can you describe what that experience was like for you?
Yeah, just so uplifting. I was just, you know, I left there actually crying when I got in the car. It's so difficult to sleep at night. You go back and you're just like, you know, the music is in your head and your dreams everywhere. But just imagining what they had gone through, you're like, oh my goodness, would I be that strong to be able to sing like this after losing, you know? They told me, one woman told me, my husband was killed before they did this to me. And you're like, oh, and she was dancing with me. We were singing. So it's absolutely amazing what music can do.
Do you ever wonder if your music actually gives them permission to feel things they haven't felt free to feel?
I think, you know, I don't want to take credit for that, but I think what I've experienced when I do that and I go into that kind of song and I hear the women going, which like what they did. And then I go, okay, now guys, can you join me in this song where I say, Kaleba? So they don't even ask what I mean. They say, so I say, Msaja agenda, Kaleba, ndabirabalie keyo, Kaleba, chinyonyi chirikuluzi. From there, it's totally crazy from there. They sing with me, they call response, and then they teach me their own call responses from there. I think the music gives them permission. It feels like it's okay that we are victims that have gone through all this, but we're also allowed to have fun.
All right, now, Samite, I'd like to close today with something you could sing for us that you might want to share, something you've written as a result of your time in the refugee camps.
I'm going to play you one that talks about, you know, a tragedy that I met, that I experienced, you know, meeting some of these young children who had seen a lot of suffering, whose parents had been killed. And they were asking, where are you, my mother? Where are you, my father? Why did you leave me behind? Because they don't understand why their parents are not there.
Thank you. Achi wandika umange Achi wandika uchitange Ensolo nezindisa Ensolo nezintwala Rachi wandika umange Rachi wandika uchitange
Beautiful. Samite Malando, thank you so much for joining us and bringing your music to us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Samite Malando is founder of Musicians for World Harmony. He joined us from Ithaca, New York.
I am from Armenia. My name is Raj and surname is Ohanyan. I have 52 years. I think that the greatest present of each one to give a person is the love. With love, we can do everything. All the people, all the world. With love, we can do everything. And the greatest present for me is it, love. And to give and to receive. Maybe when I was young, I thought that the greatest present was something material, jean, car, watch, something material. But now I think that it's more important, spiritual, love.
Coming up, we visit senior elves in Santa's Florida workshop. That's ahead on the World Vision Report. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. It's the giving season, as you know, so this week on the show, we're looking at giving and receiving. Here are voices from Zimbabwe.
I'm Martin. Best thing I ever got was my kids, and the best thing I've ever given, I blow my own trumpet, is the gift of laughter.
Hello, my name is Bout. The best present which I receive, I received a very good nice shoes from my young brother, and I gave someone a very good nice present, a bag, a very nice bag.
My dad got me a baby born. It's my favorite present that I ever got. I'm going to give my mom a present tomorrow, and it is going to be a ring.
Assisted living centers don't usually buzz with activity and excitement unless you're in Sunrise, Florida. Residents at the Spring Tree Assisted Living Facility came up with a project to improve the lives of children in Darfur. Judy Martin reports.
If Santa's workshop was relocated to an activity room at an assisted living home, and in place of elves were 24 elderly women, it might look like this. At one table, a woman traces simple gingerbread figures onto fabric. Another draws a smiley face onto the material. At another table, a woman carefully cuts out the doll patterns from the material. And at a third table, that's where you'll find Trist Cardoza, a woman in her 80s who's intently sewing the pieces together. She's a strong thread in the fabric of seniors sewing to make a difference.
I think it's great.
So you get excited about it?
Yeah. Tired at the end of the day, but I like it. I don't mind it. I'm doing it for a good cause, so I don't care.
The women here at the Spring Tree Assisted Living Facility make these toys for a project called Dolls for World Peace. Hundreds of cotton-filled dolls are piled in the room's center, waiting to be packed and shipped to children in refugee camps in Darfur, and poor children in other parts of Africa and South America.
I just think of the face of the little kids receiving those dolls, and that's all worth it.
That's Denise Duda, the founder of Dolls for World Peace. The 72-year-old also lives at the assisted living home. She says she got the idea to make the dolls while watching a news report about children in the refugee camps in Darfur. When she saw those images, thoughts of another time flooded her mind. In the 1960s, she was a nurse in the mountains of Bolivia. She remembered how the children there lived in poverty, but they still had families. Not so for many of the children in Darfur.
The baby in Darfur, their parents have been killed. They were orphans. They need food, clothing, medicine, all things that I cannot anymore provide. And I'm limited physically. I was close to tears when I saw those little babies in the crib.
Babies, she thought, who needed a doll to hold to ease their pain. So she went to Linda Forrest for help to get the project off the ground. She's the recreational activities director at Springtree.
I said, Denise, how many dolls do you want to make? She said, 1,000. I said, ha, you're crazy. You're absolutely crazy. She said, I said, 1,000. I said, okay. She said, now make it happen. And I did.
They had no money or supplies, but they had a mission, which filtered out into the community. And as if Santa had a hand in it, just about overnight, sewing machines were donated, bolts of fabric were showing up, and the activity room was overflowing with cotton stuffing. Before you knew it, they had 1,000 dolls.
That was like a miracle happening. We were expecting a miracle because everything has been miracle in that project. But for me personally, I have reason to exist.
This project fills a void for Denise Duda. She became depressed after being severely injured in a car accident 3 years ago. But Dolls for World Peace changed that. Linda Forrest, who has become the executive director of the charity, says the more than 24 women who volunteer with this project have also been transformed.
They don't talk about their illnesses anymore. They talk about, do you have more work? Do you have more work? Go buy material, go buy material. Music plays all the time. They sing, they dance. And Antoinette, who has Parkinson's really bad, and Rose, who has Parkinson's really bad, their hands shake really badly, tremors. But they just sat at the machine and sewed. For some crazy miracle, they didn't shake.
Forrest says some of the women who live with Alzheimer's and diabetes have also experienced progress. For example, Adele Levine admits she can be a little forgetful sometimes, but doesn't mind an occasional prompt from Linda.
Where are the dolls going?
To somewhere. I see. Oh, they're gone. I had a stroke. Mm-hmm. I can do things, but I forget. But I don't care. I still do what I have to do. And that's it.
And these are going to kids in Darfur and Colombia?
Oh, they're going all over the world. And it's nice. It's just a nice thing to do. I like it.
Since November of last year, the seniors, along with some help from occasional volunteers, have made an incredible 12,000 dolls. Other nonprofit groups take the dolls overseas when they go on their own trips. The delivery service, DHL, also lent a hand, sending 2,000 dolls to Darfur free of charge. For Denise Duda, those first dolls made for the children in Darfur were just the beginning.
We send now 2,000 to Darfur. It keeps on because it's no more dolls for Darfur. It's dolls for world peace. I call that a drop of peace. It's not very much, but many drops make a river. That pleases me.
The dolls have traveled even farther than Duda ever imagined. They've been included in care packages that military moms sent to their children serving in Iraq. Those soldiers hand out the dolls to Iraqi children. In Sunrise, Florida, I'm Judy Martin for the World Vision Report.
My name is Muhib Barghouti. I'm from Palestine, living in Ramallah. The best gift I have received is that I have many friends. I have peace to myself. And the best gift I have given, my pictures for the people, for the friends, because I'm photography. I'm giving my heart for the peace, for Israel, for Palestinians. peace for the countries.
Hi, I'm Dolores Avendaño from Argentina, Buenos Aires. The best gift I've ever given, I don't really know, but I think it's hope. And the best gift I've ever received is sort of the same, getting hope in times when I felt, you know, I needed it. Someone came along and helped me feel that same thing, that I can achieve whatever I want, or that things can turn out in the end well.
The financial crisis has affected just about everyone in America, from boardrooms to soup kitchens. These are especially tough times for organizations that rely on donations to help the poor. For New York City Meals on Wheels, the effect of the Wall Street meltdown was immediate and devastating. Here's Executive Director Marcia Stein.
The financial crisis has been a nightmare for City Meals on Wheels. The sudden downfall of Bear Stearns, for instance, was a $500,000 loss for us in just a couple of days. It didn't seem real when it happened.
Did you have to cut meals?
We had to eliminate an entire program. It was a heartbreaking and painful decision for us. We were, in addition to delivering meals to all of New York's homebound elderly, one meal a day, we were in addition serving a second supplemental meal to 1,400 of the 17,000 who were getting meals. Those 1,400 were people that appeared to be slipping into malnutrition. They might be losing 10 pounds or more in a month, not on a diet, but just slipping, because they couldn't live on the one meal a day they were getting. They had absolutely no other source of meals. We had to eliminate that program. That was a very, very tough decision.
How many meals do you all serve weekly?
Last year, we covered 2.2 million meals at times when the elderly would otherwise be alone and hungry.
So how much have you lost since this economic crisis began?
$1.2 million in losses from a handful of corporations through corporate matches on employee giving, through direct gifts, through special events, and that translates to 200,000 home-delivered meals.
What does this really mean for your clients? I mean, are they going to go hungry?
Some of them will, some of the time. For instance, the people, the 1,400 people who do not get a second meal, will probably continue to slide. Some people will suffer more than others, but this is a very fragile population.
All right. Marcia Stein, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're entirely welcome.
Marcia Stein is Executive Director of City Meals on Wheels in New York City.
My name is Paul Dintashi. I am here in Mekurganj in India. The best gift that I have given to somebody else, that's money. I have one story that one of my friends who was sick last year, very, very sick. So he went in hospital, but he didn't have money. So like I gave him like 500 rupees. And so right now, like these days, every day, like when we like talk about the problems, that he told me that he's very like great gift for him. The best gift that anybody have given me is the book. I always like to read the books, and like when I was in Tibet, I had a teacher and he gave me a book, and he told me that the book is like a teacher in the world. So the best gift for me is a book.
Jamaica, like many Caribbean islands, has two faces. The first is a sunny one, where beach resorts provide a welcome escape for tourists. The other Jamaica is much darker. It has grinding poverty and crime. One well-known resort company called Sandals is trying to bring the two worlds together. From the village of White House, Judith Ritter reports on A Hotel with a Heart.
A young woman in faded jeans and a tank top kneels down in a small field and hacks at the ground with a machete. She's breaking up clumped soil around fledgling leafy pepper plants.
I'm trying to get some dirt around the pepper.
Barbara Stewart and her business partner have only been farmers for 2.5 years. That's when the five-star kitchen at their local Sandals Resort needed fancy peppers. The hotel decided not to import them. Instead, and offered to give tools, seeds, and agricultural training to a few local people. It also guaranteed them a market for 33 pounds of peppers a week. Stewart jumped at the chance, and so did her partner, Melvin Jones, who used to work as an itinerant laborer.
Before I was self-employed, you had to be walking around begging for a desk job. You go out, you ask a man to give you a day's work or a week work, but no, there is no way you can fire yourself.
Freedom from the whims of bosses and the insecurity of casual labor aren't the only things Jones has gotten since he's become his own boss.
Since that, I have made an improvement. We have moved into a concrete structure with a deck top. That means that in case of a hurricane, you had nothing to worry about.
The Pepper Farm is just one of the community efforts run by Sandals White House Resort. It's company policy that each Sandals property adopt at least two community projects. But White House has gone above and beyond. The Human Resources Department helps run a school project that helps kids get dental checkups. The hotel is helping to save the island's disappearing indigenous music by hiring octogenarian musicians to play in one of its restaurants. And up in the mountains, 20 miles from the luxury resort, there's a mentoring project for abandoned boys at the Clifton Boys House. Today, Tashawn McCarthy, a Sandals landscaping supervisor, is playing basketball and just hanging out with the 32 boys, all on his boss's time.
They reach out to you a lot because some of them were grown up in broken homes, and it seems as if they didn't have much of a father figure. If they had a father figure, it seemed like it was an abusive home.
The 26-year-old McCarthy reaches up and touches his heart as he speaks about his boys.
Yes, you reach out to somebody and you actually see some improvement. It's a real joy deep within. It's a real joy deep within.
That joy Tashawn and other Sandals employees experience is one of the perks of their jobs. What starts off as an obligation, volunteers say, ends up as a privilege. The community service requirement began more than two decades ago in Kingston, Jamaica, when Sandals founder Butch Stewart started his very first hotel.
My old man believes in taking care of the people however he can. I mean, he loves this country.
Adam Stewart, at 27, is the heir to the Sandals empire, and he's the new CEO. Handsome and rich, he well might be the country's most eligible bachelor, but he's not out clubbing. He's following in his father's footsteps with service to local communities. And that's a tradition in this Jamaican family.
I must have been about 8 years old, and we were actually driving, my mom, my sister, and I, and my dad. There was a lady on the side of the road with a baby rocking back and forth and wailing. She had nothing. The car went silent. We turned around, he got out of the car, my mother went and hugged her, gave her some money, and we sat on the side of the road for like 15 minutes. That's one of those things that I think about constantly.
Back in the Rocky Hills, the sun is still high, and pepper farmers Melvin Jones and Barbara Stewart and a couple of neighbors are clearing the steep mountainside with machetes and shovels. Stewart's hands are cut and blistered. It's a tough job, but she's undaunted and almost seems honored by the chance to do this.
Some people think that cultivating stuff, right, is a degraded thing. You know, their hand cannot get messed up and stuff like that. But, you know, they are silly people. Because without foods or vegetables, fruits, you can't live, right?
Recently, Sandals put donation boxes in all their gift shops to encourage their guests to get involved in their charities. And Adam Stewart, the young philanthropist-capitalist, believes a job training program that Sandals runs could be a model for other Jamaican businesses.
We bring people in, we pay them a stipend, we teach them the skill set, and we give them a certificate, and we guarantee them work, either with us or with another hotel. If every business in Jamaica took two people in, there'd be 100,000 kids off of the street. The greatest thing in the world you can do for somebody is give them a job.
And in response to possible criticism that all this is just cheap PR, the soft-spoken heir to the Sandals empire says, "We just want to do it because it's good business to do the right thing." For World Vision Report, I'm Judith Ritter in White House, Jamaica.
leave you now with this indigenous Jamaican music. It's called Mento, and it's performed here by Sandals Mento Band Boys. Remember, you can find out more about this program on our website, worldvisionreport.org. You'll find pictures and blogs from our reporters around the developing world, and you can sign up for a podcast. The program is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Cynthia Graber and Christina Darden are our producers. Doug Boyles and Mark Bandy are our audio engineers. Our interactive editor is Larry Short. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.
Don't take me wife.